Matthew chapter 19. Have you ever had the experience you were just minding your own business and suddenly the unexpected assault? Well, I think Jesus was that way as this chapter opens. You may recall with me that last week we took a look at a section that had to deal with forgiveness and how there's such a lack of forgiveness among so many people. And the chapter opens, this is the 19th chapter, with these words. And it came about that when Jesus had finished these words, he departed from Galilee and came into the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them there. Now, whether Jesus was teaching as well, he frequently did teach as well as heal, and I would not have a problem with that. The text doesn't tell us that this was a teaching time, but great multitudes came to him and he healed them. And so he's involved in a healing ministry. And then the next verse says, some Pharisees came to him, testing him and saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? And so, in a sense, and don't misunderstand me, nothing took Jesus by surprise. But, in a sense, it's like he's minding his own business beyond the Jordan, and the Pharisees come out from Jerusalem to ensnare him, to set a trap, because a test is also a temptation. And since they had an evil motive, this is a temptation that was set before him. And so, we have Pharisees who want to talk about divorce. And one of the things that I note here, and you will too as we continue through the text, the Pharisees want to talk about divorce, and Jesus talks about marriage. And that's why we have the title to the message, such as it is. This is about the sanctity of marriage. And the point that is driven home throughout this section by the Lord Jesus is that marriage is a sacred thing. Marriage is sacred. It's holy. And this is what has happened in many cultures today, certainly our own culture. And that culture is seeped into the church life, and marriage is no longer considered the holy thing that God considers it and that the Bible teaches it to be. So, we have before us something that God ordains and something that man is required to sustain, the sacredness, the sanctity of marriage. But the Pharisees come to him and they want to test him. And here's the question they ask. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? They're talking, of course, about the Mosaic law. And they're bringing up an issue which divided the Jewish community 2,000 years ago. And I submit to you, it divides the Christian community 2,000 years later. They don't ask him, is it okay to divorce your wife? The question is it okay if you divorce her for any reason whatsoever? Or is there a narrower view? You see, there were two schools of thought among the devout. One was headed by a rabbi named Hillel, and he took the view that if a man wanted to get rid of his wife, any reason would do. He didn't like the way she dyed her hair this time, or we're giggling over this, and we ought to, but they were dead serious. Any reason whatsoever. You didn't like what she fixed for breakfast that morning. Get rid of her if you want to. And then there was the school headed by a rabbi named Shammai. And he took a very narrow view, and he said, no, that's not what the law teaches. The only reason that you can divorce your wife is because she's committed some immoral act. committed adultery or whatever it may be. And so there were these two schools of thought. And they thought they would trap Jesus because no matter what his answer was, he was going to hurt somebody's feelings. And probably I'm going to do that today too, so just buckle in and we'll all take our licks here. But here is the point. They want to talk about divorce. Jesus says, and this is our main thrust here, until you understand marriage, you can't understand the issues of divorce. The Bible defines what marriage is. Now, this may not be as easy to comprehend to us today as it surely was to these Pharisees 2,000 years ago. They asked their question, and verse 4 says, "He answered and said to them, Have you not read? This was the group among the Jews that prided themselves as bulwarks of the law of Moses, of the Bible of their day." And he says, in essence, this is a slap in the face to these guys. In essence, he's saying to them, "Don't you know your own book? Haven't you read it? It's right there. Why haven't you read it? In fact, it's in the opening pages of your book. You don't have to go all the way to Deuteronomy to find the answer to this question. If you'll just read Genesis 1 and 2, you'll have the answer." The Bible defines what marriage is, and so we're going to get the definition. "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female?" Now, there's a lot here, so if you're taking notes, you know, leave some space. There really is a lot, although I'm not trying to block this out in 1, 2, 3, 4. But the first problem that we have today is we don't believe that human beings were created. Now, I hope you do here in this room, but the vast majority of people think we just evolved. You know, we're just a monkey that lost our hair, you know, or at least most of it. Some more than others, but anyway, that's all that we are. And so here's the first error: He who created them, God created us, and there was a beginning before which there wasn't marriage, but after which there was. He who created them from the beginning did something. He made them male and female. That's Genesis chapter 1. "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness," etc. And so God made man after his likeness, according to his image. Male and female made he them. So the two genders were not an afterthought. That was God's program from the beginning, male and female. Not male and male, and not female and female. And there's a reason for that. It is so that we can procreate and have more like us, and fulfill God's command to the man and the woman, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. And we're making awfully good progress on that. Getting close to 8 billion people, it's hard to think how many more it might take to fill the earth, but there we are today. So, yes, his purpose was for male and female. Not male and male, and not female and female. So this ought to tell us something about one of the issues that's around today. And that it's hard to believe denominations struggle with issues like, is it all right to ordain homosexuals? What, is that a question? Do you have to debate that? Now, don't misunderstand. I know homosexuals, and I can love them for the Lord's sake, and their sin is not any worse than my sins, but my point is, it's a sin, and it's a sin because God says it is. And it was not his design ever, ever. And so, marriage, no matter what goes on in the homosexual community today, marriage is defined as male and female. Now, you can call cohabitation in other respects whatever you want to call it, but it's not marriage. It's not marriage. God defines it here in the Bible. So, Genesis chapter 1, his purpose was male and female right from, you'll pardon me, from the get-go. And then verse 5 quotes another verse. It's your memory verse for today. And said, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." And so there is a... And keep in mind... Well, we read through Genesis chapter 2 earlier. And just cast back in your mind to Genesis chapter 2. When that statement was made, there weren't any fathers and mothers. There was just Adam and Eve. And God created each of them uniquely. What we, I think, sometimes forget is that the book of Genesis is the first of the five books of the Mosaic Law. Genesis is not only a record of what God did and what happened prior to Mount Sinai, it's also part of the law. And this is why, I hope I'm not dragging us too far astray here, this is why chapters 1 and 2 talk about the Sabbath. It is laying the foundation for the later law of Moses that Israel was to honor the seventh day. So far as the record of Genesis is concerned, no one honored the Sabbath in the Mosaic sense of that term prior to Mount Sinai or prior to the Exodus from Egypt. There's no record of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob setting the seventh day apart for any reason whatsoever. But what we're told there is that because God ceased his creative activity on the seventh day, and by the way, it's the seventh day, it's not the first day or the third day or the fifth day, it's the seventh day. And God ceased his creative work at that point, and the emphasis that's being given is God ceased his creative work after 6 days and rested on the seventh. I mean, seriously, do any of you think that God needed rest on the seventh? Of course he didn't. It means a cessation from labor. He stopped creative work on the seventh day. And so, that's the pattern for Israel and their seventh-day Sabbath. Likewise, here in Genesis 2:24, back to the issue before us today, this verse is talking about father and mother before there ever was a father and mother. Adam and Eve are going to be the first father and mother in the world, but they themselves did not have one. This is why in Luke's gospel, his genealogy of leading up to Jesus takes us back to Adam. And all through the genealogy, so-and-so was the father of, and the other was, and this one was the son of, and the son of, and the son of, until you get back to Adam, and he's called the Son of God. It's not talking about his salvation. Talking about the fact that Adam was a direct creation of God. That's why he's called a son of God. That's why angels in the Old Testament are called sons of God, because each of them, think about the numbers here, each of them is a direct creation of God. And why saved people, redeemed people, as we sang about earlier, why in the New Testament they are called sons of God. The issue here is not gender, male and female. They're called sons of God. Why? Because spiritually, each one of us is a direct creation of God. Each one of us is born again directly by God. So, Genesis 2:24 that Jesus quotes here in verse 5 of Matthew 19 is telling us and laying a foundation for the whole concept of marriage. And by the way, if you are thinking we're getting a sermon on all the ins and outs of marriage and divorce, you're going to be disappointed. There's a lot more to be said here. We're looking at the Gospel of Matthew and what Jesus said about it here. But in any event, we look at the fact that God's plan was for man and a woman to be married, and that it was a union. A union. The man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife. I don't know about the Hebrew back in Genesis, but here in the New Testament, the Greek means to be bonded together. Not bound, like you tie something up with a string. It means to be glued together. The man and his wife shall cleave, and the two shall become one flesh. And when it says one flesh, don't spiritualize that. It means exactly what it sounds like. It's talking about the physical union of a man and a woman in marriage. And that's the sine qua non. That's the bottom line in marriage. It is that physical union between husband and wife. And that's how the Bible defines what marriage is. Now, you know, we were talking about at the break table a little earlier. You know, it's almost like, for those of you who've seen the play or the movie, Fiddler on the Roof, and Tevye and his wife are discussing their marriage, and their parents arranged it. They barely knew each other, and they were told, you're going to grow. And you'll learn to love each other, and you'll actually like each other. There's a difference between the two. And you do. You may be in love when you get married, but there may be some things you discover you don't like much about your partner, but after a period of time, you grow in your likeness of one another. In a lot of different ways. The point being that we are to be one new person. Look at the text again, verse 5. The two shall become one flesh. And based on that, Jesus says in verse 6, consequently, here's the conclusion. They are no longer two, but one flesh. If you didn't get it in verse 5, get it in verse 6, he says. They are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Last sentence of verse 6. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Anything hard to understand there? Sounds straightforward to me. Now, before we proceed, marriage is what God has ordained. You go back to the second chapter of Genesis, and we read it earlier, God said it is not good for the man to be alone. Now, we're going to come back to that in the second part of the message. But it's not good for man to be alone. So, what does God do? Well, he brings all the animals. Was this a special for Adam creation on that the end of that 6 day? I don't know. Or did he gather them, the ones he had created already? I don't know. But he brought all the animals before Adam, and Adam named them, and that became their name, and different expositors have emphasize that that is a an ancient way of demonstrating ownership. I mean, if you get a new puppy, what do? Do you do a mail out and find out what everybody thinks you ought to name the puppy? No, you pick a name for the puppy. Years ago, I got a puppy for Sheila, and she named it. It's Libby. I would have never thought of that name, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's what Sheila wanted, and that's the dog's name. And because we own the dog, I didn't ask the people at the pound, what did the folks that brought it here call it before we got. I don't know what they called it, but we call her Libby. And so anyway, the point is that yes, that did prove ownership, but if you read the text, have you not read? Jesus said, the Pharisees, well, if you read the text, you discover that Adam could not find anything that was like him. And I never can pass this by, so I'll have to ask your apology. If evolution is true, Adam should have found something that was very much like him. In other words, whatever creature it was he just evolved from. But there wasn't anything. There was no ape or chimpanzee or orangutan or anything else that was like him. And why did God do all this? God already said it's not good for the man to be alone. He wanted to show Adam how alone he was. He was unique in the world. There was nothing like him. And so, what do we read? Well, a bunch of firsts. God performs the first anesthetic. He puts Adam to sleep. I don't know how he did this, but he did. He performs the first surgery. That is, the Lord did. Performed the first surgery. He takes a rib from his side. Thorn in the flesh. Anyway, I'm just teasing with Bobby. He and I discussed this earlier. No, not a thorn in the flesh. He takes the rib and he sews Adam back up. He takes that rib and he makes the woman from the rib. Now, you can't get any closer alike than that. They're the same genetic material. And by the way, this is not cloning. All right, because if God had cloned Adam, there would have been two Adams, not an Adam and an Eve. All right, so no, it's not that. He creates the woman. And so both Adam and Eve are unique creations of God. Nothing like that's ever been done since. And then he brings the woman to the man. I've always been convinced that that's where we have the tradition of the woman being brought in a marriage ceremony, the bride being brought down the aisle and given away, usually by her father, but by some male member of the family as the norm. Where in the world did that come from? You don't see deer doing that or cows or anything. No, of course not. But it came from here. Genesis 2:24. He brings her to the man. And Adam says, okay, this is now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Everything else I've looked at, it's not me, but this is me. And you know, when God does something, he does it perfectly, don't you think? I think Adam was the handsomest guy that ever lived. I have no idea what he looked like. I know what he didn't look like. He didn't look like me. Well, I know something else. He didn't look like John either. But anyway, just teasing with your brother. No, that's all right. But he was the handsomest guy that ever lived. And I think Eve was the most beautiful woman who ever lived. And we've got a lot of beautiful women, some of them sitting in this room this morning. But Eve was the prettiest woman who ever lived. And here's something else. I'm convinced they were the smartest people who ever lived. You know, their brains were perfect. They were the smartest people who ever lived. I'm talking about IQs. You know, I don't know if Adam and Eve, if they hadn't sinned, would they have sit down and split the atom? That's A-T-O-M, not A-D-A-M. A-D-A-M got split anyway. My point is, and I need to stop making little jokes about this. My point is, they were brilliant people. Not like me. They were brilliant people. And so God put them together. And Jesus says, I'm back in chapter 19 of Matthew, verse 6. Jesus says, what God has put together, let no man separate. Lois Wells and I have a private little joke. Every time we sing one of the songs that refers to us as worms, you know, as would he devote that sacred head for such a worm as I? And that comes out of the Bible, by the way. Don't think that the songwriter was getting carried away there. But one of the things I've noticed over the years is how worm-like we are. Yeah, even the redeemed. Have you ever fished with worms? If you got a lively worm, I realize you can get some that are still half frozen, but you get a lively worm and you put it on the hook and it wiggles, I'll call it. And that's part of what makes it so exciting to the fish. All right. Well, Christians do a lot of wiggling too, and never more than on the issues that we're looking at this morning. We could be here the rest of the day with examples. And I've only been a pastor for 28 years, and I've got a book full of examples of wiggling. But what I want to, before we move on to the next, what I want to emphasize, many of you sitting here today are divorced. Some who aren't here today have gone through divorces. And if you have gone through a divorce, you know that here at Grace Bible Church, we love you and do not think a whit less of you. Furthermore, we know very well that when you come down and stand before the preacher and you got married, you weren't standing there thinking, I can't wait till I can get a divorce. Nobody thinks that way. You know, we're thinking about the good things of marriage. But yes, divorces do happen, and that's what we're going to get into now. But the point is, your being divorced doesn't matter to us in the sense that we love you the less. We sympathize, we're sorry, and I've never met a divorced person that told me, boy, I had such a great time with my divorce. I just loved it. No, of course you didn't. It was an agony. And you hated to have to go through that procedure. But again, I do understand sometimes it happens. The Scripture understands that too. Our Lord understands it. And so they bring up the next question. They said to him, this is verse 7, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce her? Now, this is the section that I've called Man Must Sustain. God has ordained marriage. Adam didn't go to God and say, I'm lonely, make me a wife. God knew that it was not good for the man to be alone. So God made the wife. And guess what? Adam said, wow, you've done, wow, this is great. This is exactly what I need. I didn't know it before, but I needed a wife. I think we've always all been that way ever since. I was going to stop making these little quips, so I'm going to try. In any event, the question now is, why did Moses say it was all right? And notice the word they use here. Why did Moses command? And Jesus corrects them. He said to them, because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted you. There's a difference between a permission and a command. Moses never commanded the children of Israel to divorce their wives or divorce their husbands, as the case may be. It was permitted, but it wasn't commanded. what was commanded was that if you divorce your wife, you can't just throw her out the door. You have to go through a legal procedure, and she has to have a document in her hand. And you say, well, what's unusual about that? Well, it may not be unusual in America today, but it was unusual in the ancient world. Even among the Romans, who, boy, you want to talk about legalists, the Romans were big into law. But a Roman husband could just dismiss his wife, put her out the door, and that was it. You know, there was no... But under Mosaic law, there had to be a document, a certificate of divorce, for the protection of the woman. All right, now, with that in mind, Jesus said Moses did not command, he permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it has not been this way. Now, that takes me back in my mind to verse 4. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning? You got to go back to the beginning. And in the beginning, there was not divorce, there was marriage. Marriage is sanctified by God. He's the one who ordained it, created it, if you will. And so, he says to them, the only reason Moses permitted you is because of your hard hearts. Divorce is not God's plan. Divorce does happen. The Mosaic law recognized that, and New Testament law, so to speak, New Testament teaching recognizes it as well. But before you can understand those issues, you've got to understand marriage. And so he said, it wasn't this way from the beginning, but because of your hard hearts, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives. What does he mean by hard hearts? Well, you go to the book of Hebrews, and it talks about a heart hardened by unbelief. They don't believe what God says. And what does God say? He talks about a man leaving his father and his mother and cleaving to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Don't separate what God has put together. It has not been this way since the beginning. God's plan is not for divorce. And so, Jesus goes on to say in verse 9, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. Boom. You don't hear that much anymore. Certainly not in the court system. Here's where some of the wiggling comes in, fellow worms. The wiggling comes in when you come to this exception. By the way, Matthew is the only one who records except for immorality. When the other gospel writers record Jesus' teaching, the exception is not given. I'm not trying to make an exception of the exception. All right. If he says except for immorality, that's what it means. Some immoral, indecent conduct. So I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for immorality. The exception is for the divorce. In other words, Jesus is giving permission. He's not telling you you have to, but if a divorce has to take place, maybe because of persistent immorality, then that legitimizes the divorce, but it doesn't legitimize the remarriage. And I challenge you to read 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Ephesians chapter 5, 1 Peter chapter 2, and discover that the remainder of the New Testament verifies and simply gets more specific about what Jesus is saying here. So, it does not mean that if your spouse has committed immorality, committed adultery, then that leaves you free to remarry whom you will. It does not. It means that this negates the marriage. And when I say that, I probably shouldn't have said it that way. It means that the marriage is over. If you insist on it. But it's not commanded. In other words, no one says if your spouse has committed immorality, you must get a divorce. But if the spouse insists on it and there's nothing you can do legally, well, then the divorce takes place and you are not guilty of adultery when that happens. But it does not mean that you can just go ahead and remarry. And the rest of the New Testament will verify that. Again, I said we weren't going to go into all the ins and outs of marriage, but we were going to stick to Matthew. And so we shall. And so what's the next issue that comes up? Well, it's the issue of celibacy, not being married at all. The disciples said to him, this is verse 10, the disciples said to him, if the relationship of the man with his wife is like this, it is better not to marry. But he said to them, not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it has been given. Here's another wiggle. I heard this not too long ago. The individual related this statement of Jesus, not all men can accept this command or this statement, back to Jesus' statement about divorce and remarriage. And they took the view that if you can't accept what Jesus said, well, then you can just ignore it. You know, it's not given to everyone to be able to accept what Jesus said. So let's consider two things here. Number one, here's where I'm going to hurt feelings, I guess, if I haven't already. I heard on the radio one time, J. Vernon McGee said that the reason for this exception in verse 9 is so that the innocent party can remarry. In other words, you're not the one who committed immorality, so you can remarry and it's okay. And I don't know, maybe out in California, McGee found people like this. I'm still looking for a guilty party. Everybody I talk to that's gone through a divorce is innocent. It's my wife or my husband, as the case may be. They're the ones who were the wicked people. And don't misunderstand, I'm not so naive as to think that everybody's guilty or everybody's innocent. I'm well aware that there are some more so than others. Some may be entirely so. But the issue is not so that you can get remarried. So far, I haven't found anybody that I couldn't remarry, because everybody that I've talked to is innocent. But they are when they want to get remarried. Anyway, here is the other statement about this. You know, we can just ignore Jesus if we're not able to accept it. Well, first of all, the reference in verse 11 is not to Jesus' previous statement. It's to the disciples. That's true grammatically, and it ought to be obvious from the context, as we're going to see in a moment. So, not all men can accept this statement that it's better not to marry. Didn't we already have an indication from Genesis chapter 2? God said it is not good for the man to be alone. So, if you want an exception, here's an exception to the man being alone, or the woman being alone, as the case may be. Only those to whom it is given can accept this statement about not marrying. Normally, we get married. That's the norm. That's God's plan. Divorce is not his plan, but marriage is. But there are rare exceptions to God's plan. Celibacy, not being married, is one of them. So, verse 12. And again, compare what we're about to look at with 1 Corinthians chapter 7. You'll see that they blend in completely. For there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. People who are incapable, physically incapable, of the marriage union. And again, what is marriage about? It's the physical union. This is the basic foundational truth. It's the physical union of man and woman as husband and wife. If we're just talking about a platonic thing where, you know, you just have a blending of the minds and you like each other and get along and that sort of thing, well, being physically incapable of the physical union doesn't have any effect on that. So we're talking about the physical union as husband and wife. And so he says there are eunuchs that were made that way by men, and there are also, third category, eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And he's talking about people who have made a conscious decision not to marry for the furtherance of the gospel. I'll put it in those terms. And some people don't. Some men, some women go out to the mission field. They serve the Lord on the mission field, and they never marry. They never marry. They remain single their whole lives. Is that true of most? No, not even of missionaries. But it's true of some. And it's true in many cases because they've deliberately devoted themselves to the Lord and they're not going to marry. There are some who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. He who is able to accept this, let him accept it. And so, is celibacy an option? Yes, it is, but it's not a matter of take this test and see if you are, you know, if you get all the answers. No, it's not that. God has to lead you because his normal plan is for men and women to marry. And it's the exception, and I believe a rare exception, for a man or a woman to devote themselves to the Lord and not marry. So, is marriage sacred? I believe it is. Who makes it that way? God does. What's our responsibility? Keep it sacred. Devote yourself to what God's program for marriage is. Forget about what society says about it, because society changes and goes up and down and back and forth and twists everything around. It's what God says that matters. I'm going to ask Andrew and Sheila if they'll come back to the piano and challenge us with this matter of devoting ourselves to God's will concerning marriage. And that's 397. I have decided to follow Jesus.